Okay, today I have Allison with me, who just got back from Tunisia, sort of the place you would consider the birthplace of the Arab Spring. And it's probably one of the only Arab Spring states that is, I want to say, not on fire. I mean, I don't mean that as pejorative, but it seems like with Syria and Egypt and the Gulf, there's been a lot of violence and a lot of protests. Where in Tunisia, we haven't really, I mean, at least to somebody like me, we haven't really seen a lot of, you know, violence and protests. So today, Allison is going to talk about Tunisia, her travels to Tunisia. And then for the second half of the show, we're going to talk about Tunisia's economy. So, you know, what has been the government's plan in Tunis to rehabilitate the economy? You know, what is, you know, Tunisia's relationship with the United States, with China, and with the EU? And that's the conversation. So let me start off with, you know, Allison, describe, you know, your travels to us. I mean, you know, as I said in the intro, Tunisia is considered the birthplace of the Arab Spring, and yet we're not seeing a lot of violence coming out of Tunisia. So, I mean, describe your travels and describe, you know, what you saw while you were in Tunisia.
Yeah, so thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure. And I've always been really fascinated by Tunisia for a long time now. And I've always wanted to go there, especially to check out the economic situation. And I was there right before the assassination of opposition leader Mohamed Brahmi. I believe I left about a week before that happened. And everywhere I went, I got the feeling that the political deadlock regarding the drafting of the constitution had created a sort of de facto lull in political activism. But there were indicators all around me that anything could spark it and that anything could kind of tip the scale into violence.
Interesting. So, I mean, in terms of...
So I talked to a lot of youth who are in their 20s.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, so I talked to a lot of youth who are in their 20s, and the general consensus was that Ennahda had done nothing for the country and needed to be replaced as soon as possible. There were a couple of kids who told me that, you know, it wasn't so black and white, that Ennahda was also doing some good things, or that it was doing the best it could given the circumstances, or that, you know, they felt more comfortable practicing Islam post Ben Ali. But there was still that feeling that it wasn't totally stable, that this was just kind of a chimera.
So, I mean, you know, what was in terms of economic prospects? I mean, if people our age is, you know, they're saying they're more comfortable practicing Islam. I mean, what are the sort of financial aspects of this? I mean, are they able to find work? Are they able to go to university? What is, you know, for somebody our age in Tunisia, what is the financial outlook for them?
Well, the financial outlook for them is that they will probably go to a state-run university. But I did talk to a lot of graduates who were unemployed and who were looking to work elsewhere in the world, anywhere from South America to France, just looking for a way out of the country so they could actually find employment. And I spoke to one woman who was actually entering her fourth year of unemployment and had a degree in English and could not find a job. So unemployment is still very high there. It was about 13% before the Arab Spring happened. And then at its peak, it was around 19%. And I believe today they actually just announced that there is about a 0.6% drop. So we'll see if things get better, but I'm not very optimistic given what I saw a few weeks ago.
Interesting. So, I mean, what is the government doing to sort of fix the economy then? I mean,
it's a difficult question because they're not actually doing much. The issue with the political gridlock is that the Ennahda, the Muslim Brotherhood, hasn't really focused on the economy very much. They've more tried to focus on, you know, gaining popular support for their policies and for what they want post-Ben Ali Tunisia to be. So there really hasn't been much done on the economy, actually.
I mean, why is that? I mean, is there, what have they chosen to focus on? I mean, it seems like what you've described to us is, you know, the economy is a big issue, but yet the government is not choosing to focus on the economy. I mean, what else is it focusing on?
Well, I really think they're focusing on creating a cohesive base for support, because there are still a lot of opposition parties out there. And although they're fragmented and incredibly divided right now, they're still powerful enough that should they become one group, they could possibly take the government down. And I really think that Ennahda has really been focusing on consolidating and securing their position as the leaders of Tunisia.
Interesting. So, I mean, you sort of describe the Tunisian economy to us. I mean, is it something that is, you know, there's a lot of high tariffs and a sort of, you know, describe, I mean, I think a lot of folks, you know, describe the Tunisian economy before the Arab Spring and sort of after it. I mean, what have been sort of the sectors that have suffered, and what have been sort of, you know, has everything in the country sort of, you know, everything related to the financial and industrial sector has sort of dropped off post Arab Spring? Or,
well, you have the two of their major industries suffering immensely. First, you have tourism, which has been severely affected by events. I was at a beachside resort called Amamet for a day when I was there. And normally in the summer, you would be on the beach and you would see all of the chairs full of people. People from Algeria, people from Eastern Europe, people from France, Italy, Germany. And yet it was quite clear that the hotels were not at full occupancy and the beaches were relatively empty. And you could tell that that was not normal and that the industry must be suffering. And then you also have the phosphate industry, which is one of Tunisia's other main industries, which is also suffering because of protests in Gafsa, where those production plants are located. They're protesting against the horrible economic conditions and the constant unemployment. And those constant strikes have meant that exports have decreased and that industry is losing money.
Interesting. So how would you describe sort of Tunisia's relationship with the United States then? I mean, you know, do you think the United States is sort of approaching Tunisia correctly? I mean, is aid money working? I mean, is that an avenue that has been helping the Tunisian economy in this sort of state?
Well, I'm sure that aid money has been helping in some way, because, you know, you see things like loan guarantees and debt relief funds, and I'm sure that those are working as band-aids. I'm sure that those packages have helped Tunisia from totally crumbling. But it is not a good long-term approach.
Interesting.
And it isn't sustainable.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I mean, have they been able to sort of, has U.S. aid been able to sort of stand up a sort of free market? I mean, you've written an article, What is Wrong with U.S. Aid to Tunisia? And it really seems like, you know, U.S. aid has, as you said, has been able to sort of guarantee loans and sort of big blocks of money. But it almost seems like at the same time, a lot of standing up a market and revitalizing small business is, you know, it's less in the hands of the U.S. and more in the hands of the Tunisian government in terms of legal and sort of legal reform.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And that is where the aid programs you see, mostly funded through USAID, are kind of misguided, because they operate under the impression that Tunisia has a free market economy, which it does not. It did not under Ben Ali, but it's even worse now, because under Ben Ali, at least it was the well-oiled machine of privilege. So you had bureaucrats who knew how to do their jobs. Now with Ennahda in power, there's all sorts of confusion and the red tape is even worse. So even though Tunisia's economy has opened up slightly since the Arab Spring, there are definitely some signs. I definitely heard that it's a lot tougher to get things done there in terms of free enterprise and the private sector.
So, I mean, like, if you're an entrepreneur in Tunisia, I mean, this isn't like the United States where you have to, you know, incorporate and then file some other forms. This is, I mean, what you sort of describe and sort of I've read about is it's a sort of formalized system of bribes. I mean, and you're saying that, you know, the transition from, Ben Ali to this current government, I mean, it's gotten worse. Like, so if you're an entrepreneur, you have to deliver more bribes and more connections. I mean,
yeah, well, if you're an entrepreneur, chances are, you know, the connections you may have had 3 years ago aren't there anymore. And the institutions are just not as strong as they used to be. One thing that the people at the World Bank really emphasized when they talked to me was the banking system. Because what's happening is you have, within the banking system, you have people making decisions about loans, let's say, for a construction project. And those are the same people who are making decisions about a loan for maybe a green entrepreneurial initiative. And those are two totally different kinds of projects that require different expertise in terms of determining whether or not to give someone a loan. And so you don't have anyone specializing in helping out private enterprise get started.
Interesting. No, I mean, you also make the point in your sort of your longer article, I mean, the public sector. I mean, so is the public sector then growing? I mean, it seems like, you know, Tunisian telecoms and sort of phosphate production and even, you know, those two big industries are, they're owned by the state. So, I mean, is there really the first step to a better economy in this case of public sector reform?
Public sector reform is definitely needed because there is obviously a high degree of corruption. At the same time, though, I really don't think that Tunisia can thrive economically and be fiscally solvent without creating a viable private sector as well. Because you have, if your public sector is too bloated, that creates all sorts of other problems that countries like Tunisia have had in the past and don't want to have again. I really think that it's going to be the private sector that's going to drive the rebuilding of Tunisia eventually once it gets established.
So I'm curious then, I mean, are private companies, private US companies, private European companies, and even Chinese companies, I mean, are they investing in Tunisia? I mean, is this, I mean, it, you know, ignoring the public sector reform for a minute, I mean, are companies wanting to be in Tunisia? You know, private companies?
Yes, and actually that is the really interesting thing is you have, not China so much, but you have Japan. Japan has invested a ton of money in Tunisia, and there's even a bridge on the outskirts of Tunis that they call the Japanese Bridge because a Japanese architect built it. And you have the Japanese pumping a lot of money into actually private sector reform initiatives as well as aid programs. And then you also have companies from all over the world investing in Tunisia as well. The European Bank for Reconstruction and Development actually just gave millions of dollars to an international oil and gas company to develop their wells that they have found in Tunisia. And then you have even big companies in India. You have an Indian fertilizer and chemicals company that just last month invested tens of millions of dollars in a joint venture in Tunisia. So clearly, despite the unstable political climate, companies still think that it is a wise investment.
Interesting. So, I mean, but it's definitely, though, it's big established companies. So, I mean, so in the sense that it's not necessarily creating new markets, but reinforcing old ones? Is that accurate? Or
yes, I would say so. Although the oil and gas market does seem to be relatively new. it does seem to be growing in a way that it wasn't before. And I definitely have read more in the past couple of months about more companies coming in to drill exploratory wells using very expensive high-tech equipment that's has a lot of risk attached to it. So when you see those kinds of things happening, you know that these companies really do think that it is a wise investment.
Interesting. So, I mean, I have a question for you. I mean, you, I think it was a week ago, you tweeted at me that, or at the Loopcast, I can't remember which account, but that Huawei was in Tunisia. So, I mean, you do have, I mean, are they, in terms of, you know, inviting companies to come in, I mean, you know, do you think that sort of companies that are associated with China or even Japan and India, you know, countries that don't necessarily emphasize human rights and, you know, that sort of thing, you know, do you think they have an advantage? I mean, or do you think, you know, the United States, China, Japan, and India are all sort of on equal footing? It's just that, you know, China, Japan, and India were sort of the first countries to come to Tunisia in terms of big contracts and big business.
Yeah, I mean, I really do think that everyone is pretty much on equal footing here. The interesting thing about Huawei is that Tunisia's telecoms industry before the revolution was really known for being just filled with cronyism, totally monopolized by the state, full of corruption, and not letting any other provider in. And then I was in a suburb of Tunis driving around and I saw a big Huawei building that looked very new. And that was an indicator to me of China's reach, especially in North Africa. Particularly China and Japan have definitely been investing a lot in African countries lately, and it's showing.
Interesting. That is very interesting. Huh. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, you know, we've sort of come to the sort of the end of my questions. But I mean, did we miss anything? Did we, you know, is there anything you want to sort of make the audience aware of?
Yeah, I mean, you know, given recent events, you have the National Constituent Assembly was just suspended, which means that the constitutional process is going to be further stalled. And you also have Ennahda now refusing to step down, calling for a national dialogue to solve the current crisis, and offering a national referendum as a solution. Meanwhile, you have tens of thousands of people protesting in the streets a few nights ago. You had sit-ins in front of the parliament building in the Bardo. And now I'm seeing a lot of comparisons to Egypt in a lot of media outlets. This doesn't even touch on the issue of Islamist militants on the border with Algeria who are regularly clashing with Tunisian security forces. And, you know, they're threatening to become an even bigger presence in the country. So while there are maybe some indicators that the economy is getting a little bit better, I would not expect it to get much better if this political unrest continues, and I would expect it to get much worse.
Interesting. That is a very bleak picture you've drawn us. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
It was a great trip, but
right.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.